today's topic, I know Dr. Lee for quite a while, and I took his class several years ago. I really enjoyed his class, and his books have been inspirations for me too. Today's topic is, I'm talking about the literacy development in Song China, the promises and the constraints. The focus is on the literacy conditions which makes literacy development in Song Dynasty possible, and which also makes exercise some controls of the development of literacy in different aspects. So there will be four parts of it. The first part is define literacies. If you notice, I put this as the plural form. The plural form is, it implies that there are different types of literacy and at different levels across different disciplines. And the second is conditions and indicators for literacy development. The third is, I try to use Shen Kuo's book, Meng Xi Bi Tan, the Dream Pool Essays. I try to translate it differently, and I noticed someone also translated it as Brush Talks from the Dream Book, because it has carries more implications and connotations that he tries to convey. So I try to use Shen Kuo's case as the case to argue for the advanced literacy achievement and constraints at a particular period of time, and then some tentative conclusions. So I will continue with that. Originally, I planned to read my paper, and I know we have got experts here, and I feel that I, if anything, if I talk offhand, anything which is, I'm not sure, please let me know. So I will try my best to stay on course. Okay, first of all, let me define literacy. Literacy is defined broadly nowadays in the social-cultural perspective. Social-cultural perspective defines literacy not merely as the ability to read and write, or traditionally we look at literacy as being the ability. Thank you, Anthony. As the ability to read and write, including such aspects as word recognition, spelling, vocabulary, grammar, and as well as comprehension. These, to some extent, are the basic literacy. So according to the social-cultural perspective, and particularly from Heath and Foss and Purvis' viewpoint, this is not sufficient. We also need to look at literacy abilities as the ability that we incorporate, we use these skills, and we demonstrate certain behaviors that will require individuals to be able to use the skills to critically think about and respond to and engage in extended reflections and interpretations of a written piece and the evaluation of other evidences. Now, this tends to be a very broad definition. In a way, some of the cognitive scientists would disagree. They will say, well, you are going beyond it. But if you look at the comprehension research, the most update comprehension research, you will find this actually fits very well. Because if you think in terms of comprehension, how do we comprehend? We comprehend because we use prior knowledge. Not merely we recognize the word, not merely we put sentence together, but we also understand, we bring in what we have, try to understand the message the author conveys. And also we sometimes read more from the text than the author intends. So to some extent, that particular aspect of a definition for literacy not merely broadens our understanding of literacy, but it's much more accurate depiction of the literacy situations itself. So the second is, furthermore, the researchers trying to look at the process of acquisition, that is, how actually an individual acquires literacy. Well, there are two things which comes out which stands out very prominently. The first is functionality. By functionality, the assumption means that literacy has certain abilities to perform certain tasks in the society. For example, the letter writing abilities in a society which letter writing is used. So it has certain functions. The users in the individuals in the society needs to learn these in order to use it. So it has its functions. The second aspect is called meaningfulness. Meaningfulness refers to the individuals rather than to the potentials of their particular literacy skills. That is, the individuals on the part of the individuals, whether I want to acquire it. Now, how meaningful it is to me, what's the purpose of it that I need to learn it? To some extent, what it actually points to, if we have to use a layman's term, looking at the education, we're calling this as motivation. Now, of course, the motivation could be very broad. If we are looking at the motivations in terms of the personal gains, we can also look at motivation in terms of the social gains for the social benefits. We can also look at motivation as a general understanding of what this particular thing will do for me and what it means for me as a purpose. So this is generally the definitions. Now what I'm going to talk about now is looking at, first of all, the linguistic characteristics of Chinese. Now, when I look at some China's literacy development conditions, I'm looking at two types of conditions. One is the functionality condition, which I try to borrow a logic term, and it means the necessary condition. That is, the conditions which will be necessary. Without it, the literacy functions won't happen. The second part is the sufficient condition. Sufficient condition refers to the meaning part. That is, for the individuals, if they don't see the purpose, if there is no motivation to acquire it, then the literacy itself won't be realized in the society. So now, first of all, I'm talking about the condition. The conditions here is the necessary conditions and the indicators for literacy development. Before I do that, let's look at Chinese language, characteristics of Chinese language. There are several aspects which are relevant to our talk, so I just try to highlight these. First of all, Chinese has that particular characteristic of oral language tends to be much more detached from the written language, as in alphabetic language. Now, some of you won't agree with me because when you write in your own dialect, it's still coming out as written form. But if you notice, what I mean is the symbols and the signs that we put down as the written language tends to be not exactly mapping the sound when we speak. So, for example, people across the seven major dialect areas will be able to speak their own dialects and still be able to write the same language, the written language, and be able to communicate that. Now, this is a very good feature because it's stable. It allows people to communicate across dialectal zones, but it is also a major obstacle, the major obstacle for communication. Particularly if you look at literacy as communication needs, then it poses that particular obstacle for creating the literacy conditions. So in order to communicate across dialect zones, for one thing, you need to be able to talk in a common oral language, like the Guanhua in Song dynasty, or like the Yayan before, and like the Putonghua we are now using in mainland China, and Guoyu in Taiwan. So that's the first condition. The second is you also need to be able to use some of the written language to communicate if that particular oral facility is not available. The second linguistic characteristic which has a lot to do with what we are talking about is the aesthetic features of Chinese written language, by which I mean not merely through calligraphic expressions of this language, but also through the visual form of it. Now, the visual form of it seems to be a very important component in Chinese language. If you look at English language, take English language for example, alphabetic language has that particular mapping of the sound onto the part. So the visual representation of it is mainly on the spelling part. It's not focusing on how beautiful the spelling is being expressed. Well, you may still say, well, you have got very good handwriting, but it's not like in Chinese situation when the calligraphic expressions are not merely the aesthetic expressions, but also the expressions of one's character to some extent. We used to judge people by the handwriting. So of course we cannot do that, but it seems to be a kind of tendency. So this particular characteristic of Chinese language, it's not totally linguistic, so it's kind of misnomer when I put it in, but it has its importance. And I think particularly its importance when we consider the usefulness or the persistent use of the woodblock printing in Song Dynasty. If you think in terms of the woodblock printing, it was created in such a way that it was supposed to be written by someone first, and then the wood covers were carved according to their handwritings. So the handwritings are being preserved. And anything which is more mechanical, I don't think it will carry the same weight as the woodblock printing. So to some extent, when it was unfortunate Beeson invented that particular movable print types, but at that particular time it was not used. I think it has a lot to do with the Chinese language as well, but I may be wrong. Okay, so let's move on to the necessary conditions and indicators for literacy development. First of all, the civil service examination systems, there are a lot of research focusing on that, and Dr. Lee wrote a lot of articles and books have talked about that part as well. Civil service examination system in China in Song Dynasty provided or created that particular necessary conditions for the literacy to spread. That is, it allows people to vie and compete for the few seats available, and it also is, to a great extent, a fair opportunity for everyone to participate. Now, I think you have a very excellent discussion in your book about just and fairness in terms of civil service examination participation. I think to a great extent it is fair. It opens the door for the first time for the commoners to participate. They may not be successful if they don't have that particular monetary support or don't have that particular family support, they can sustain them for a long time of study. But still, it's the first time when this is open, this opens. And so it provides opportunities for the literacy development. Second is the commerce development. At that time, the commerce in Song Dynasty, Song Dynasty China was a very unique society. It suffered a lot in terms of its It suffered a lot in the hands of foreign invaders, and it also had, I think if I'm not wrong, if we look at the largest dynasties, it has the smallest territory from Han onward. And however, it has one of the most advanced commerce in the world at that time. And someone even speculated that the reason they moved the capital, they established the capital in Kaifeng, is because of its convenience for the commercial activities. So that particular commerce development allows the traveling and the communication to happen more than the agricultural life. That by itself, if you consider the language, if we consider language characteristics, that is for the communication sake, and if we also consider the characteristics of commerce, of trading, it requires certain kind of basic literacy skills to have. So the commerce development by itself, I have some data in my paper. I didn't have my paper here, it's in my bag. Can I get the paper? Okay, for the first time in the history of China, a tax law was published officially. Though it was taken from the previous dynasties, it was published officially by the government in the Song Dynasty. And it was posted by the door of every tax collector office, collection office. It's for the traders to see, for the merchants to respond to. That demonstrates the importance of trade taxes to the government and the society. If you look at the trade income, the tax at that time, it was really it was tremendous tax. Trading have brought tremendous profits from taxes and trading surplus. For example, in foreign trade, more than 1,400,000 guans annually by the end of Northern Song. If you think in terms of the income, think in terms of the tax collected annually from a city of 1 million dwellers like Kaifeng at that time, it was 3.5 times more than the tax they collected annually from that particular city. It's a lot of activities going on. The expanding commerce required better means of monetary transactions, particularly when trading long distance. Paper money, for example, called credit, almost like called jiaozi, was first officially used in Song China around 1024, which in turn should have facilitated the trading mode change, such as multi-site trading and quick turnaround. Merchants using this mode of monetary transaction should need some communication skills to communicate and interact with communities of the local people, and the literacy skills, say, to understand the tax laws posted and make short-term trading decisions based on local commodity information. Therefore, expanded commerce activities and the potential trading mode change would require participants to be basically literate, capable of doing simple reading and calculation. The third one is the social relation changes. because of the development of the urban of the cities, urbanization during Song Dynasty was moving rapidly, both in size and in numbers. For example, Kaifeng, the capital of Northern Song, had about 1.4 million people in 1021. Hangzhou, the capital of Southern Song, had a concentration of about 2.5 million people in the late 13th century. There were a dozen other cities who have populations of more than 200,000, which were usually the capital of various lus. Most other big cities and the townships were located in Liangze regions, with the population ranging between 100,000 to 150,000. The city dwellers, including merchants, soldiers, the night watchmen, day laborers, craftsmen, entertainers, monks, clerks, travelers, students, scholars, officials, they were more dependent on each other for their lives, yet less related to each other in family lineage. If you think in terms of their being removed from their village, they are really now not self-sufficient in terms of the livelihood, but they are less connected with the people who supply them with the livelihood. So it's a very different life now. It would be the simplicity and land-dependent hard work that characterized village life in the countryside gave way to the sophisticated connections and open mobility in city life. It would be very hard, if not impossible, to live a successful city life without the basic literacy ability and the communication skills, such as understanding each other or locating a new place in a city. As city absorbed more people in Song China, the relationship between landlords and the tenants also underwent a gradual change that made tenants less like indentured dependents on the landlords than lessees of the land through some mutual understanding or contract. The loosening of the dependent relationship would allow more flexibility and mobility for the tenants on the assumption of a more equal ground for their negotiations of their land leases. Such social relationship change, together with the city booming, made it possible for people to pursue other interests than the traditional farming life. So that's, again, is a kind of necessary condition, but it may not truly happen if people don't pursue it that way. And the schools, of course, schools is the education was a key issue and a focus in Song China. With the civil service examinations in place, Song China began to see the need to have the previously dilapidated schools restored. Government-sponsored schools were gradually set up at various levels, ranging from Guozijing in the capital to the country schools, to the county schools. So there are a lot of schools. The peak of the government schools were during the three education expansion campaigns in the social reforms. According to one calculation, there were about 653 schools established throughout Song China at the prefectural and county levels, usually supported by government endowed land. In the year of 1104 alone, there were more than 200,000 students who were supported by government stipend. I cited Dr. Li in that particular quote. Private schools in the form of traditional family schools, winter schools, and village schools should have been very popular and served the basic literacy and the beginning education needs. Yet, aside from anecdotal and fragmentary reports, we do not have exact estimates about the number of schools at these levels. However, private schools in the form of academies and its like, such as Jingshe, focusing on advanced learning, were estimated to be at around 464 in Song China. Yet its educational capacity and influence, when combined with family education and self-study, could outstrip government-sponsored schools. Very interestingly, I got that interesting statistics from your book, and I calculated, look at that. It's a very interesting combination. One interesting figure cited in Lee 1984 is very revealing about the impact of private education. In one prefecture, Fuzhou, in 1165, there were more than 17,000 candidates sitting in for the triennial examination from the prefecture, while the prefectural schools had only about 300 students in that year. So it means most of them are coming from the private education background, or at least not in that particular year enrolled in the government-sponsored schools. And given the usual proportion of one prefectural school to three county schools at the time, if you look at numbers of the county schools versus the prefectural schools, that's 1 to 3. And if we assume that the county schools may have the same number of students, usually they have fewer students, right, as the prefectural schools, then we will say that at that time, there should not be more than 1/10 of the candidates coming from the government schools of the region. That is, it's no more than 1,700, four schools if you add them together. So still 90% of the candidates are coming from the private education background, or at least not that year enrolled in the schools. So that provides us with at least another necessary condition. It means the schools, there are numerous, and the private education opportunities are numerous. So the opportunities available, these are the necessary conditions. And the print technology. Print technology at the time, as soon as we all recognized, it's one of the most advanced techniques they have developed at that time. It not merely perfected the techniques of woodblock printing, but it also has invented the movable type print, it's clay type. And I think it's really a genius to create a clay type, because most of the time we use the pear wood. Pear wood tend to get stick and can tend to get decayed if you use it as the movable type. So it's really a very genius invention at that time. Printing houses run by the government and the private sponsors and the family printers sprung across the country. For example, the central government-run printing institutes belonging to Guo Zijian, Chongmenyuan, and Si Tianjian printed various books running from classics, examination references, legal documents, agricultural manuals, to official calendars for a general intended for either the official giving out, mostly in Guo Zijian case, or also for the profit for sale, mostly not in Guo Zijian. In Guo Zijian alone, in the first 45 years of the dynasty, the wood blocks number jumped from 4,000 to about 100,000. That is, this is also kind of inconvenient without the movable type, because you have to carve each block for each page that you're going to print, and have to keep it for the later print as well. So it's a 25-time increase at the time. Family printers and the private printers were also popular and printed various books for preservation in the case of family printers and the profits in case of private printers. In places such as Liangze, Fujian, Sichuan, and Jiangxi, where papers were produced and of high quality, printing business were usually highly developed. By one account, there were about 173 printers during the Southern Song period. The development in printing led to the sharp reduction in book prices and made books, including textbooks, relatively cheap to own. Bibliophiles collecting more than hundreds and thousands of books in Song China were numerous, and were usually themselves very learned scholars and connoisseurs in collating and editing books. So the schools provide opportunities, and it's also part of the necessary, the print institutions provide the books available for the students to own. And then the intellectual development. Intellectual development at the time, of course, we all know the Neo-Confucianism. That's the name we later on add to it. However, the idea about Confucianism was becoming very popular in the Song China, and the civil service examination exclusively used classics as its examination topics or subjects. The tradition of Confucius and Mencius were revived and refined through reinterpretations of their works and the classics they endorsed. The scholars and scholar officials reflected on their social responsibilities and role of knowledge and learning in realizing their social and personal responsibilities. They highlighted the way in Confucianism, emphasized the relationship between life and knowledge, and promoted way-seeking through self-cultivation based on a continuous learning. Shuyuan, the academies, and other private schools became the most relevant places for scholars to develop and disseminate their thinking. The intellectual activities of these scholars were fueled by the availability of books through print, drastic changes happening in the society, and encouragement by government on building schools on all sorts, of all sorts. Okay, so these, to me, are the necessary conditions. They create the social conditions in which the literacy can develop. They also create the social institutions in which the literacy could be delivered. And of course, there are also thoughts and understandings of how these literacy could be used as means. So literacy looks like it's on its way to develop in the Song Dynasty. So there are some indications. By indications, I mean, if you look at Song Dynasty in literature, Song China witnessed the emergence into maturity of two forms of literary creations, the Ci poetry and the vernacular fictions. Both forms had two things in common. First, they adopted oral language into their texts and therefore were freer in expression. Second, they tended to express the subject matters of commoners' concerns, which were usually not part of the formal poem's subjects. And then there's the curricular focus. Thanks to the efforts of recruiting officials from civil service examinations, Song China has seen an emphasis on Confucianism and the classics in school education, which was sometimes too closely associated with examination to be desirable. Various efforts were made to promote classics in orthodox ways throughout the dynasty. So these are some of the indications. Even in the elementary school, for example, Zhu Xi made an effort not merely to compile elementary school books himself, but also he tried to advocate the orthodox ways of being incorporated into the content of the textbook, of elementary textbook, trying to replace these popular elementary literacy textbooks. Of course, we also noticed by the end of the Song Dynasty, there was coming to being the three-character classics, which tend to fit more into the Confucius tradition, a new Confucian tradition in advocating not merely the sequence of learning, but also the morals and the virtues to be advocated.
Okay.
Now move on to the next. These are the necessary conditions and some of the indicators that is possibly this happens because of the literature and because of the curriculum focus. There are two things I consider to be sufficient conditions of the meaningful part. One is the cultural milieu toward literacy growth. The other is the government policies and the practices. And both of these things tend to have some different directions to go. As a society that cherished the long history of a uniform language and social unity, China had a peculiar preference for literacy skills. Perhaps the most obvious demonstration of this tendency was in the reverence for anything written, particularly in the written history, from the oracle characters to the butterfly format binding of the books. There lied a consistent awareness of the role a written language has for a country, recording, guiding, rejuvenating, and harmonizing. People looked up to the classics and the past histories, not merely for understanding what had been and what had been done, but also, more importantly, for guiding their present pursuits, solving present dilemmas, and founding peace with the world and nature. In Song China, this reverence for the past writing was further fueled by the civil service examinations, print technology, and all the necessary conditions we talked about before. However, Chinese culture could be prohibitive too. As many writers and historians have pointed out, China has been an agricultural society that originated in a vast and self-reliant plain with rich soil and terrain. That geographic characteristic seems to have contributed to its cultural and national features and behaviors. Chinese culture was land-bound and had special reasons, such as political and practical reasons of keeping stability and unity, to encourage land-related production and activities than otherwise. Therefore, in the traditional hierarchical order, farmers, if you look at the four occupations, not occupation classes that we look at, farmers came second only to gentry or a scholar official class and ranked above artisans and merchants. While such an order may not be surprising for any agricultural country, because it's very common for all agricultural countries, it sent an unmistakable message about the relative importance and value of activities associated with each class. It would seem natural for scholarship and literacy to be sought after. However, at the same time, devalued professional activities such as those associated with artisans and commerce. Therefore, even urban life itself. In a sense, the profit-making activities of commerce and the invention-oriented processes of craftsmanship and manufacturing were not as valuable as the food-producing husbandry. Even scholars who succeeded in seeking officialdom would either purchase land during their tenure or retire to the countryside when retirement came. Such a land-bound tendency in cultural preference was not conducive to the widespread promotion of literacy use among farmers, though moving up the social ladders to the scholar official rank would certainly encourage these few farmer families that could afford to send their prodigies to schools. However, there was little cultural incentive for encouraging farmers to adopt or learn behaviors emanating from travel-prone and communication-dependent commerce activities and social group-oriented craftsmanship and manufacturing. Among these behaviors were functional literacy skills of communication, both in terms of simple reading and conversing abilities. So commerce activities and urban development were not combined well with cultural milieu for encouraging popular literacy growth, as well as critical thinking literacy skills among those who were ranked under the gentry scholars. If we have to summarize this, what I mean is really the literacy itself does not spill across the occupations. it does not spill over to other occupations. So for example, the farmers, they have no incentive to learn the literacy skills or the skills which are relevant to the traders, to those who are engaged in manufacturing. The government policy and the practices. Government policies and the practices with regard to the different classes of people also reflected the tensions that did not eventually lead to widespread literacy. As in the previous dynasties, government policies concerning merchants and other less land-bound classes were usually negative. For example, at the beginning of Han Dynasty, government issued policies to suppress merchants, which policy later lapsed in the same dynasty, of course. In Song Dynasty, such policies were loose. Different classes, such as merchants and artisans, as well as monks and Taoists, had the freedom to go about their own business. However, these policies were apparently still in place when officials were being selected. For example, all monks, Taoists, merchants, government clerks, and artisans were officially prohibited from taking part in the civil service examinations in the early part, in the early years of the dynasty, and on and off throughout the dynasty, and in different places. However, there were also official edicts that allowed honest and talented among them to participate in the examination. The message is you have to be honest and you have to be talented, so you could be different from your own kind and could participate in it. Furthermore, their sons could receive education and sit in for the examination if they proved themselves to be talented and worthy. Yet, constraints on them existed. For example, even the local elite recommendation practice for participating in the central level of the examinations could work against merchants and others whose occupations would require them to travel beyond their native land most of the time during the year. Despite inconsistencies in the policies and practices, one message was clear: that activities and the mentality associated with those occupations were not highly desirable and therefore should be avoided if one was to achieve social status through examinations. In other words, there is no incentive to, once again, to go beyond one's occupation except to move to the scholars and official ranks. With the government policy and the practices usually were against those who engaged in commercial and artisan activities implied, the possible levels of literacy associated with these occupations could hardly rise to the degree of wide-scale dimension dissemination and the spread, that is, it's not spreading. And the need for such a skills acquisition could be an existence within the occupation itself. However, to move beyond the occupation as a general skill, it was not encouraged. In addition, the cultural milieu and the government policies would not reward efforts of moving towards more advanced literacy skills, such as systematic and objective expertise thinking or scientific thinking. A quote from Yuan Cai would speak to the general atmosphere about expertise. Those who are not capable of being Confucian scholars may make their living without disgracing their ancestors by working as spirit mediums, doctors, Buddhists, Taoists, farmers, merchants, or experts of some sort. Furthermore, on the specific areas where advanced literacy skills, such as scientific and critical thinking, would have been developed, the government practice made them impossible. The most obvious examples would be the use of astronomical expertise in making instruments for astronomical observations and official calendar making. While unofficial calendar printing was cracked down, astronomical instruments and skills for observing the astronomical phenomena and the celestial bodies, calculating the calendar years, remained exclusively the royal palace privilege. The related advanced literacy skills, such as scientific observations and recording, mass calculations, and fine instrument manufacturing, did not get promoted and advanced. In some necessary conditions in Song dynasty might have allowed widespread basic literacy skills, and it apparently it has. Yet the examination of the sufficient conditions seems to indicate that this possible widespread was more downward but not moving beyond occupation, and there was little signs of advanced literacy skills development in the society. Well, I want to use Sun Kuo's Meng Qi Bi Tan as the case to indicate, to illustrate the last point. Sun Kuo was held as one of the greatest scientists in ancient time in the world and in China as well. Yes. Thank you. So I approached his book of Meng Qi Bi Tan by analyzing its content, both in terms of the different categories and some of the instances in which the tension of the skill development, literacy skill development, and the constraints on it was reflected. So the first part will be looking at the classifications. These are the items that he had in his book. The items are different in length. The items could be as long as more than 2 pages, but could also be as short as just 1 sentence. And when you look at these categories, the first category is what I called the officials. There are 22 items or the entries connected with it. But if you look at science, of course, is a big number, right? It's 151 in my calculation. So it includes medicine, astrology, astrometry, inventions, buildings, and the math, geology. Then if you move on, the linguistics and almost archaeological efforts on his part would consist another about 80 of the entries. And then the arts and literature, of course, he's held as one of the greatest men of letters as well of the time. It's 89. And if you move up, I'm going to see another big number of the miscellaneous big number. Yeah. And if you look at the economy is 27 and miscellaneous is 156. If you look at, people usually regard this book as a scientific book, as a book which is records a lot of scientific phenomena and keeps a lot of Chinese understanding of science. But if you look at this particular book, interestingly, in terms of its content, it's more like any of the narrative notes and essays of the time than like the scientific book that we have been thinking about. So the classification tells us something that is, for him at least, that particular part, maybe his intention to keep some of the scientific things in there, but it's not his main focus. It's less than 30% of the total. I think one thing which really enhances our impressions of what we got from looking at this particular table is some of the implicit message he sent. The impressions we got from examining the table were reinforced when we took an in-depth look at his own preface to the book, some of the entries in the book. So if we look at his that's his preface as to why, preface to his book. It's kind of interesting. It's almost like an apology. Kind of implied defense about why he did it and what was in there. I have returned to the countryside. This is my translation, so it's not truly accurate. I tried to capture what I was thinking is in there. I have returned to the countryside to start a secluded life, to live a secluded life. Recollecting what I talked with guests before, I would record one of them at a time in writing as if I was still talking with the guests. They went by thus without my notice. What I have been talking to is only my brush and ink slab. That's the name Brush Talks. As to the country policies, as to the policies of the state, state affairs, and the palace and official businesses, I've not dared to record in private here because they're not they're not allowed to do that for the official history. But at some time, actually, they have a lot of private histories written at that time. As to anything associated with reputations of current officials, I would not even record their virtuous deeds, which was not merely to avoid saying anything bad about them. What I recorded were only the things that have nothing to affect others' careers, things that would serve as topic for light talks while enjoying the nature. It includes street gossips and the like. However, due to the nature of the oral communication, I don't guarantee that it is free of errors. It would be too trivial to treat the book. Now, to me, this is the key. It would be too trivial to treat the book as my stand on matters, as my perspective on matters. It would be appropriate to regard it as an indication that I have no interest whatsoever in establishing my stand. What he is saying that whatever you infer from the book, don't blame on me. I do not intend it, and I have no interest in establishing my viewpoint about any of the things I talked about here. It's very interesting to me because the constraints of the government policy and the practices on his thinking were clear. He tried to explain that he just recorded what he would talk with guests when they were engaged in light talks. It was obviously a note to be read by those who would very likely find possible blasphemous statements, including the act of writing itself in here, that would send him into even deep trouble, deeper trouble than he was in at that time. He was forced into the retirement. So it's explicit statements about what was included were made. Describing what he did not intend, Sun Kuo showed that he was quite aware of the practice of scholars not engaging in writing history of the country and the palace. Therefore, he declared that he did not take any stance in his triviality recording, maybe implying that he was not implying his encomium and criticism as Confucius did in the spring and autumn. This trepidation was hardly groundless for an old politician who knew the danger of being misinterpreted at the time. His self-introduction furthered that sense of keeping to himself and not caring anymore about the official affairs. Just read the beginning and end of it. He was talking about why he was there in that particular area. He dreamed it a long time ago, and then he got the piece of land and he retired into the land. He lived there. However, by the end, he said, living here for 4 years now, this old man was sick. He called himself Wong, so I put it as this old man. You can say I. A year later, the health worsens as a rotten wood. Will this old man shed his skin here? He was talking about whether his health will further deteriorate in that area. He was actually not truly enjoy, as he said, enjoy wine and Li Bo's poems and exchange mentally the poetry with them. He was actually thinking of the outside world as well. And old man was described who tried to appear to be nonchalant to any worldly business,
but be accompanied only by his poems, wines, and other free time companies. This almost detached description of his isolated life resonated so well with the preface in sending an implicit message about the constraints he felt the government policies and practices would be on him. Such a mood is not what a carefree old man truly has. Very interestingly, once again, if you look at the official matters he mentioned in his Meng Qi Bitan, it only occupied a very small amount. He tried to stay away from them, but he could not. As a scholar, he was talking about these things which are only of interest to him and to the scholars and the scholar officials. And I think it will be very hard for anyone to justify that these will be of common interest to the common. And also he had, in his scientific pursuit, that's one thing I tried to make, in his scientific pursuit, when he described the scientific phenomena, he usually has that particular open-minded approach, will say, if I don't understand, I'll leave it open and I'll leave it for the later experts to examine. But sometimes he also gets into that particular heaven-man harmony situation by saying, and particularly with the Wuxing understanding in there, if he cannot explain it and he thinks there is no way to explain it, particularly through his observation, he will say, well, there is no way to explain it. It's just part of the things that we cannot explain. One of the most famous things will be when he was talking about the compasses. He was talking about how the needles, you rub it, it will point towards the south. And of course, he introduced different methods, and he said the best way is to hang it up with the silk, with the bit of wax in the middle of the needle, and it will point towards the south. And he pointed out, he said, there are some needles, once you rub it with the magnets, it's going to point towards north. It's slightly towards the east, south. Will point towards the north. But why? He has no idea why this happens. So he eventually resorts to saying, well, of course, it's just like the cypress trees points towards the west. The needle sometimes points towards the south and points towards the north. So it's kind of interesting to see the descriptions and particularly the way he tries to resolve the conflict in scientific phenomena he could not observe. So I think generally he is a very open man. But in that particular case, I think because of the restraints of the government policy and the practices at time on certain things they can do, certain things they cannot do. For example, the astrology business is actually exclusively the government business. No one in the commoners can issue the calendars. They can to some extent, this particular exclusive use of certain scientific knowledge limit the development of scientific thinking. We know scientific thinking not merely comes from our engagement with the activity and the process itself, but it also comes from the exchange of the information, the possibilities of seeing the advancement of it. And as a matter of fact, when he was talking about that Hun Tianyi, he was talking about it was not as good, not as well made as it was before, even if they did it according to what was hidden in the palace, the manuscript in the palace. So we can see that particular type of scientific pursuit is not part of the things that scientific thinking is not being developed. So advanced literacy skills was not truly exercised and pushed to its potentials. Okay, so in conclusion, there were some indications that Song China had the necessary conditions for mass literacy and more advanced literacy levels of literacy. However, the cultural as well as the government policies and practices of the time might have limited such growth. Given the conditions listed, we may hypothesize the following. Basic literacy in Song China was really moving towards commoners. Though functional literacy beyond their own occupation could be unlikely. the advanced level of literacy, such as critically evaluating evidences and objectively reasoning, did not happen, though both the government policies and social priorities would restrain such growth into full-bloomed scientific pursuit in Song China. I think take out though, both the government policies are not favoring and the cultural milieu. As one of the greatest scientific thinkers of the ancient China, Shen Kuo certainly made tremendous contributions to China's scientific development, but his limitations also represented dilemmas that China's advanced literacy faced, withdrawing easily when faced with constraints in cultural practice and the government policies and the practices. In addition, the brush talks would not go beyond what interests scholars and the scholar officials. In conclusion, I think what we see is the sufficient conditions sometimes could restrain what necessary condition could actually offer. Song China was a very good example of that. It has all the potentials to develop into full-blossomed industrialized countries or scientific thinking aligned, but it is not. So thinking about modern-day China, we may have the same impressions. We had experienced cultural revolution and a lot of other things which are truly controlled by the ideological understandings and the political atmosphere. Okay, thank you very much. This is my... Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very high